Good afternoon. We'll call the House Education Finance Committee to order. And we do not yet have a quorum, but as I indicated yesterday, there were three testifiers who were with us to talk about the topic of early childhood that we couldn't get to, and I apologize again to those of you for having you come back another day, and I'm so glad you were willing to do so. So with that, we're going to proceed with those three testifiers first before we turn to our topic of post-secondary and career learning opportunities in our high school. So would the representatives from Mini Minds come down to the testifier table?
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you so much for allowing us to come back and share our story. My name is Denise Mayotte, and I'm the Executive Director of the Sheltering Arms Foundation and also the co-chair of the Start Early Funders Coalition, which is composed of over 25 foundations that fund early childhood programs here in the state. Also, my colleague here is part of that. Start Early is a proud member and the funder of the Mini Minds Coalition that's made up of over 100 organizations statewide that all recognize that ensuring that our most top-risk children have access to quality early learning programs and needs to be a top priority for the state. And I believe in your packets there are some handouts about the members of our coalition. Many of you probably have seen that before, but just in case. Our coalition represents parents, early childhood providers, businesses, foundations, advocates, public health, public safety, teachers, administrators, and many more, and a growing list. The group all understand that our state's achievement gap is unacceptable, that it starts early, and that it affects us all. The research is clear that investments in early learning are one of the most important and impactful the state can make. The research tells us that, and some of you may have heard these bits from research, but just in case you haven't, I'll let you know that 90% of brain development occurs before age 5, and a large portion of that before age 3. That a high-quality early learning program can help to mitigate stressors that could disrupt healthy development and have a lifelong impact on vulnerable children. That kindergarten readiness is a strong indicator for academic achievement as well as lifelong achievement. And that low-income children who enter kindergarten behind rarely catch up and are more likely to need special education, more likely not to graduate from high school, more likely not to attend post-secondary education, and more likely to suffer societal detriments like incarceration or health problems. However, on the other hand, low-income children who are exposed to high-quality early learning environments and who enter kindergarten ready to learn are significantly better poised to succeed. So today I'm here to support our proven scholarship model. You heard a lot about that yesterday. The model helps children enroll in high-quality early learning programs. And this is based on the success of the scholarships that are already supporting over 5,000 low-income children in Minnesota. As you've heard, these scholarships are flexible, they're parent-directed, and they follow the child to provide the stable support that low-income families need. This investment builds on the successful scholarships that are already changing the lives of many across the state. The scholarship funds can be braided with child care subsidy funds, and the scholarships help support our state's diverse child care system that's composed of private providers, schools, Head Starts, and more. Because also, as you heard yesterday, that the current scholarship funding supports only 10% of eligible children, Mini Minds supports an expansion in funding for scholarships for 3- and 4-year-olds and their younger siblings. And I'd ask you to turn to the second handout that is the Mini Minds vision on what we hope to ultimately achieve to see the 20,000 eligible children here in the state served by scholarships. We know that you have a lot of competing interests this year at the session, but there really is not, you're not going to find a better return on your investment than targeted scholarships for children at risk. And we really thank you for your continued investment that brings so much on previous success for the young children of the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Mayotte. I appreciate your testimony very much. And Ms. Yost, did you have any comments you wanted to add to that?
I do. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I work for West Central Initiative out of Fergus Falls, and I used to be a family child care provider. I worked also in a child care center and in school readiness and ECFE.
I'm sorry, but would you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, Nancy Jost.
Thank you.
So, first of all, I'd like to thank you for the scholarships that you have provided the funding for in the previous 2 years. And I would encourage you to increase the number of scholarship funding so that all of rural Minnesota has access to them. I live in West Central Minnesota, and only 4 out of our 9 counties have Pathway 1 scholarships. So 5 out of our 9 do not have the ability to have scholarships right now. I think scholarships are good for families. It allows them to work. It allows them to choose high quality care. I think it's good for children because they can be in high quality care. Parents like them. We've heard lots of stories from parents that they like the scholarships. And providers who have served families with scholarships like them, and that includes family child care centers, Head Start, and schools. So that's just a little bit of a rural perspective on scholarships. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jost. We very much appreciate your testimony. So, all right. Thank you again. We very much appreciate your good work and your testimony today, and again for coming back a second day.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
All right. Now we have a representative from the Children's Defense Fund, Peggy Flanagan. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Peggy Flanagan. I'm the Executive Director of Children's Defense Fund. I also am a recovering school board member from Minneapolis, and so I appreciate the good work that you're doing here. I wanted to talk to you today about Part C, early intervention. But before I get to that, I just wanted to mention briefly and to touch on a different subject of family economic security and how that impacts achievement in our young people. Poverty, especially early in a child's life, affects brain development and is harmful for outcomes related to achievement skills and cognitive development. This means that family economic security is an education issue. Children's Defense Fund will be working this session to improve family economic security by making child care affordable and accessible. And we see child care as a two-generation approach to creating family economic security because it allows parents to work and children to succeed, from which I benefited directly as a CCAP kid growing up. It also supports the development of a strong workforce, but child care needs to be affordable for many hardworking Minnesota families. It is not. We will be advocating for increased investment in the child care assistance program, and our state has failed to make critical investments for more than a decade. CCAP is a vital and effective program covering care for children birth through 12 during all hours of the day and work week when parents may need to work full-time at different hours. Unfortunately, more than 6,000 children are on a waiting list because of lack of funding. And additionally, provider reimbursement rates have been eroding for some time, forcing most providers to take CCAP families at a financial loss if they take them at all. Even through CCAP legislation will not come through this committee, we felt it was important to bring it up here as we know that family economic security is really a foundation for achievement in the long term. So now I'd like to talk about Part C intervention services. Part C early intervention, which falls under the IDEA, is an effective program for infants and toddlers with developmental delay or who have a physical or mental condition that is likely to result in a developmental delay, such as Down syndrome, fetal alcohol syndrome, etc. Currently, it serves about 5,000 children in the state. Part C services, which could include physical therapy or occupational therapy for gross or fine motor developmental delay, speech therapy for speech delay, or many other services for types of delay, are coordinated and delivered through a child's school district. Early intervention services are delivered in a child's natural environment, usually the child's home, with the child's parents or caregivers as an active participant in the therapy sessions. The Minnesota Department of Education, the lead agency for Part C, works with both DHS and MDH to find eligible young children to deliver these services. One of the difficulties for Part C can be finding infants and toddlers of families who are traditionally have very few connections with the school district. As such, there are about one dozen intra-agency early intervention committees throughout the state that work to connect with families who may have an eligible child. We believe strongly in this program and want to ensure that children and their families can connect with these critical services. According to a 2009 Minlink study, one-third of children who receive Part C services did not need special education by second or third grade. CDF and the Visible Child Initiative of the Family Housing Fund believe that Part C program can be especially beneficial for young children who are homeless. Our homeless infants and toddlers experience developmental delays at more than four times the rate of other children. 54% of homeless infants and toddlers have a developmental delay, and the majority have a delay in more than one domain. As a result of this legislation that CDF and the Visible Child Initiative brought forward in 2013, MDE now tracks and annually reports to the legislature the number of homeless infants and toddlers referred to Part C. According to their first report, which was published in July, which I will provide for the committee, eight infants and toddlers were referred to the program. However, according to the Wilders Research 2012 study, 840 infants and toddlers are homeless on any given night in Minnesota. Our young homeless children are invisible, and it is important. It is an important program. We need to make certain that they are served. One way to make homeless children visible and to help ensure that they receive critical early intervention services is to make them categorically eligible for Part C through an at-risk definition of developmental delay due to an environmental or behavioral risk. A handful of other states have expanded their Part C eligibility to include children who are homeless, though it is important to note that most states require more than one risk factor to be eligible. That being said, the trauma of homelessness almost always means that children have experienced a multitude of risk factors during their very young lives. Poverty, witnessing domestic abuse, having a parent with an undiagnosed and untreated mental illness, and living without safe and stable housing. Part C is an important component of the early childhood continuum of services and a critical piece to the school readiness puzzle. And we believe this is especially the case for infants and toddlers who are homeless. We look forward to working with you to ensure that infants and toddlers are on track to meet developmental milestones so they can have healthy childhoods and productive adulthoods in Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Flanagan. I appreciate your testimony. Any questions? All right. Thank you again. We appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
And lastly, I have Brad Lindell from Schools for Equity in Education. Yes, and while Mr. Lindell's coming down, we do have a quorum now. So, Representative Newton, looks like you're ready on the spot with the minutes. If you would move adoption of the minutes. In your packet?
I'd like to move adoption of the minutes.
All right, thank you. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. Thank you very much, Representative Newton. And Mr. Lindell, very briefly, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lindell, Schools for Equity and Education, a coalition of 58 school districts located throughout Minnesota, both metro and non-metro. Be very brief today. This isn't an issue in which we traditionally step into, but because of all the interest this year that's going to be on early childhood, we believe that it's very important that the organization take a stance. There is a I gave to the committee, I believe, the our position paper on it. Generally, we are looking for ways to service a broader range of 3 and 4 year olds. It's very, very difficult. Given kind of the nature of the scholarships to get to all the kids that we need to get to. That's not to say that scholarships don't work in certain instances, but we're looking for broader range solutions to preparing our 3 and 4 year olds for kindergarten readiness. I think we are talking also, I think, two of the challenges that are out there as you look at any of these solutions. The space issue and also the transportation issue. There are many districts that, with the advent of all-day kindergarten, are stretched in space terms, and adding early childhood to that will also cause some some structural challenges. We are aware, though, that there is a facilities report that the Department of Education has put together that we're working on that would help alleviate a number of those issues in the school facilities challenges. So, again, feel free to contact me, contact the organization as we move forward, and as this discussion takes place, we're glad to take part in it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. We appreciate it. All right, members, with that takes care of having our testifiers who were not able to get in yesterday be completed. So we're now going to turn to the plan topic for today, which is kind of the other end of the spectrum from early childhood, focusing on post-secondary and career learning opportunities in the high school. And we're very pleased to have representatives from the Department of Education here to make a presentation to the committee. And then a number of witnesses, and I'm certainly hoping we can get through all of them today. Again, we may have to limit some of the witnesses or all of the witnesses to about 5 minutes each and that, but we will do the best we can to get through this very important topic. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Education. As the Chair mentioned, today we'll be discussing the lay of the land of post-secondary opportunities in the high school setting and the benefits that provide for students and families. I have MDE staff here with me, expert in the area, to discuss the issue. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to her.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Paula Palmer, and I work for the Department of Education as the Director of the Office of Career and College Success. So today we're going to talk about opportunities for students in Minnesota's high schools to take advantage of, and there are many of them, so please thank you. I appreciate your patience in going through these many different types of opportunities that we have. Before we start, as you know, there's been an agreed upon definition for career and college readiness, which you see in front of you, and it really is in its essence about providing students the knowledge, skills, and competencies to successfully pursue a career pathway. And what's lovely about this definition is it definitely opens up our definition of post-secondary success, which includes not only our traditional 2 or 4 year college going pathways, but also preparing students for moving right into career and technical education career and technical fields, as well as maybe perhaps right into the workforce with some sort of credential or certification. This is an interesting piece of data that I think is nice to frame the conversation, and there is not necessarily a cause and effect that we can directly attribute to this data, but what's interesting about this is what we have found is that students that take 3 or more career and tech ed courses at least 240 hours and or take some sort of PSEO or concurrent enrollment, which we'll talk about what concurrent enrollment is, they have a much higher rate of graduation in all of our subgroups, including special ed and our special population. So I just think it's interesting to share that information. Just a quick little quiz to start us out. Nationally, what percentage do you think that people between 18 and 65 have a post-secondary degree or credential? And know that on the average, our nation is Minnesota is reflective of the nation. You can just take your secret guess. 35%. So we know when we look at the workforce needs, we know that we still have a lot of ground to cover in making sure that everybody's ready for post-secondary. An interesting statistic around where our students go, which does have some relevance to our post-secondary or our concurrent enrollment options, that we look at this graph that shows where our students who graduate generally go, what type of institutions they go into. There's two main pieces that we're going to cover today, and we're going to briefly talk about what we know as the personal learning plan legislation that you passed in the last couple of years, which requires that all students have some sort of post-secondary plan, transition plan to post-secondary, starting no later than grade 9. So we know that it's not just about having options, but also assuring that students and families know what those options are, how to navigate to access those options. And that is the first part is the personal learning plan legislation 120B-125. And it also requires that schools assess students' interests and aptitudes so that can help guide and inform their decision-making process while they're still in high school, as well as what they decide to plan for and pursue after high school. So we talk about different kinds of college credit opportunities while still in high school. And concurrent enrollment are any kind of college level courses taught by high school teachers. They can be mentored by college faculty. For example, some of you might be familiar with College in the Schools, which is something offered through the University of Minnesota, as well as perhaps online. Dual enrollment is when college courses are on a college campus and or high school, and they simultaneously, students are able to earn both high school credit as well as college credit. School-based are, we have new early college models that are emerging in Minnesota, where again these are located both on campus and at the high school level, and again they're simultaneous high school college credit. And this has just been opened up to our alternative learning targeted students. Advanced coursework, like advanced placement courses and international baccalaureate courses, are high school courses that are taught by high school teachers. And there are end-of-course exams that students can get credit for, either by the course themselves, passing the course themselves, and or their passing exam score. Credit for prior learning. Students can take different kinds of national challenge exams to also earn college credit, as well as in some of our career and tech ed programs, we have programs of study that offer a career pathway that students can earn high school credit and post-secondary credit with an articulated agreement between the high school and the college institution. Eligibility for PSEO, post-secondary enrollment options, is another very highly subscribed to option that our students take advantage of. And there are some prerequisites for that, and they are generally open to 11th and 12th graders. However, there is new legislation that opens this up for 10th graders to take career and technical education college-level courses. There are some new updates to the PSEO legislation. We know that we want to make sure that students and families have all the information and those options are truly accessible for all students. The waiting for the payments to colleges for that tuition conforms with the per pupil weight that is appropriated to school districts. This legislation allows that colleges to advertise or recruit to high school students in school districts with 700 or more students in grades 10 through 12. And it also allows students in ALC or alternative learning centers to be enrolled in earlier middle college programs so that they can receive dual credit, both high school and college credit. Also, by March 1, there is a requirement that every district provides up-to-date information on their website and in materials and distributed and counseled to both parents and students about PSEO so that they're fully aware of those enrollment options. And there's also the new piece about colleges must enroll a student who qualifies as a veteran if the course is offered to a secondary school pupil as well. There are teacher credentialing requirements. I bring this up because this is often brought up, because depending on the concurrent enrollment or dual enrollment or the PSEO option, there are certain credentialing requirements required depending on the institution. So, for example, in our MinSCU system, there is a requirement that the teacher who teaches that college-level course have the same level of credentials and qualifications to teach that as the college faculty. Whereas, like, the University of Minnesota has a different system and a different model where they have a structure that allows the high school teacher to be mentored by a college faculty and therefore then, you know, pass the requirements through their training and their demonstration that they're able to teach that class, that they can teach that class at the high school and grant, then the institution will grant the college credit for a passing score or passing that course. And then one other piece that comes up too in this conversation is there are some new models emerging in Minnesota where there's option for an actual degree to be earned while still in high school, and there are requirements that occur with that being partly with a portion of that program or that pathway option being taught at the high school, but a portion must be taught on campus as well. And there are some other kinds of requirements that go into that, but you've probably heard a little bit about those, and you will probably be hearing more about those as they are becoming more popular in the nation and even in Minnesota. Just a little graph that is a little outdated. We're still looking for the newest information, but you can see some typical college pathways that students take. We all know students who may start out on the 2-year and then move to a 4-year. We know students who start out with a 4-year and persist and finish to the, you know, through the 4-year system, or private and or public. And this is just a nice little graph that shows some of the alternative paths and what the tuition may look like in those different types of pathway options for families. So that sort of contextualized then our next conversation, which is a question that we're often asked, is what is the savings to a family for a student to take these college credit opportunities while still in high school? And that is an interesting question and a difficult one to answer because there's a few caveats that influence what that savings number would look like. And that would mean that we have students who sometimes enter and enroll in these courses but then don't finish. So even depending on the college's policy on dropping and, you know, what their drop policy is, we still may be obligated to pay that tuition. As well as, you know, what the number doesn't show is which students actually passed the course. We still are, again, paying for that course. So we don't necessarily have that ability to track that. And we also, what this number that you have in front of you is contingent on is if the student both enrolled and then attended post-secondary, obviously after graduation, and was awarded the credit. And this is a very important thing. Each institution has the autonomy to determine if that high school college level course is indeed granted credit, or that end of course exam is indeed granted credit. So that's something that's out of the scope of the secondary system that is up to the colleges to decide. So when that question is asked, what is the savings, we can give you a number based on how many college credits, and you can see that. PSEO, 154,655 PSEO college credits were taken last year, and at the average MINSCU cost of $193 per credit, that's a $29 million savings, but again, those other variables influence that. So we just wanted to make sure that we pointed that out. So we kind of gave you a comparison of what it would be a savings for families pursuing MINSCU system or the U of M system or a private college system. And then we provided you with the data around other concurrent enrollment other than PSEO savings for families. So what this is important to know is our investment in our reimbursement process that we offer school districts for concurrent enrollment and PSEO reaps multiply in the end for families, even if not all of these students who enroll actually are granted the college credit. So I wanted to show you also the concurrent enrollment aid for programs such as where, again, where districts, we know that we have 292 districts or charters offering concurrent enrollment, and the statute allows that concurrent enrollment courses can be reimbursed to districts up to $150 per course. However, because the appropriation is $2 million, it isn't sufficient to cover that whole cost. So this is the prorated breakdown of what that ends up to be to districts. Districts will then, if they apply for reimbursement, can get $33.47 back for every student in one of those concurrent enrollment courses. And even at a $6 million appropriation, it would still only cover about 150 of the 100 of the 150 allowable. So it's an, you know, it's, I needed to be able to share that, how that plays out for us in the end for school districts. Credit for exams. This is something that many of us are familiar with. We know students who take AP exams and IB exams. In Minnesota, we've had an increasing number of students of all backgrounds taking these exams. And last year, we had almost 41,000 students taking AP at 67 exams. And of those, 44,000 of those exams those students received passing scores for the AP. And for the IB, of the 7,470 exams taken, we had 5,000 of them receive passing scores. So if all was well and that student went to post-secondary with that passing score, they would perhaps be able to receive credit for those exam scores. IB and AP, the appropriation, again, this shows you how that breaks down. We are obligated to pay for all students covering their exam fees 100% if they're free and reduced or low income. And then after that, the rest of the exams are prorated, or a portion of their fee is covered by this appropriation through the state reimbursement process. So that covers very, very, very briefly and quickly the college credit opportunities that students have in secondary school. And again, this is more of on the finance side of things and not a lot of programmatic information, but we would be happy to give you more information if you need it on that.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer and Mr. Ernie. I appreciate it. I do have at least one member on the list, but I had a couple of questions for you first. And looking at this, I'll start from the back here first with a question on the funding to pay for a concurrent enrollment aid, and that you talked about the appropriation and how it's insufficient to cover the course load in that. And the appropriation of $6 million would pay approximately $100 of the $150 allowable reimbursement. Do you have an estimate if we fully funded the current concurrent enrollment use, what that number would be?
I could get that for you. And again, that's sort of relative, as you know, that, you know, we've had a real influx of participation in the last couple of years, but we could look at the trends in the last couple of years and we could provide you with an estimate.
Thank you. And I understand maybe our nonpartisan research may have some of that information. Okay. Mr. Stroms?
Madam Chair, the current proration on the concurrent enrollment is about 17%. So appropriation about five times as large, between $9 and $10 million, would cover the $150 if the courses stayed at the same level. As Ms. Palmer pointed out in the graph of hers, those courses are increasing each year, so that would be a growing appropriation for the next couple of years.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And Ms. Palmer, what are you seeing in terms of trends? Is there a way that you could categorize increases in participation that you're seeing from year to year? Is there a sort of an average increase, or does it go up and down? What trends are you aware of?
Madam Chair, we have seen an upward increase in all of the areas, in all of the concurrent enrollment programs. And you can see on the map that we provided that almost every single district has some sort of concurrent enrollment in PSEO. If you're asking Paula what my prediction would be, I would say that this is only going to increase. As we know, the cost of post-secondary is becoming, you know, just definitely quite an issue for families. We also know that we have much better recruitment and information systems, and with the new legislation, 120B, 125, for requiring that all students have a plan, and within that plan, there's a requirement that students take some sort of advanced courses, or at least to their ability. We believe that that will influence and continued increase, as well as new need, significant need, and trend towards expanding career and technical education. So we believe that this trend will not decrease by any shape. In the last 5 years, it has only increased. I don't know that we've ever seen a downward trend. So, but we can play with that a little bit if you'd like some more hard estimations. We certainly could do that.
Well, thank you. Yes, and anything you want to forward to the committee, your best guess would be appreciated. I agree with you, and I think the demand is going to increase, and you know we'll have to do some significant planning in that area as we look to our budget proposal. So thank you. All right, so Representative Quam, I have you first on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And looking at your table of the different options and costs for the Black Baccalaureate degree, I'm trying to understand the underlying numbers because there isn't a linearity. Are you using the assumed average year one and year two credits taken to come up with the dollar totals?
For the tuition totals? Madam Chair and members, thank you for that question. This is information that I've received from the Office of Higher Ed, and I can inquire at the actual how they calculated that, but I would assume it's your average course taking, nothing more, nothing less, at each one of those institutions in a year. But I will definitely find that out for you from the Office of Higher Education.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that, because it'd be good to understand, you know, the students that take the first year and then the second year, they tend to take a 15% higher course load. Does this take into effect? You know, it'd be nice to understand the mechanics, because it doesn't look towards a linear situation, so that there might be other loading, you know, for the students, and I'm just trying to understand the full picture. So I'll try and get that information offline.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Palmer, on the chart for concurrent enrollment aid that I think the chair was referring to, I have a couple questions. Your tuition examples for Minsky, for example, and the U of M, that's per semester hour, isn't it? That's not per course.
Ms. Palmer.
Madam Chair and Representative, this is per course. That's my understanding.
Per course. Okay. Seems awfully low.
Representative Newton.
And the other figure, the 3347.
I'm sorry, per credit.
Per credit.
I'm sorry.
And that was the question that's leading into the 3347 per course that you show how the appropriation
right.
is prorated. That's for a standard 3-credit, 4-credit course. Is that what it is?
Mm-hmm.
That's not per credit.
I'm sorry.
Is that per credit also?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure which you're
Ms.
pointing
Palmer.
To.
It. You say the statute allows concurrent enrollment courses to be reimbursed up to 150. However, the appropriation is insufficient. Therefore, the appropriations prorated amount is reduced to 3347 per course.
Yes, Madam.
Not per semester hour.
Correct. Palmer.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representatives, that's correct. That's per course. So it's sort of an agreement between the institution and the school districts that they offer that course at that rate to the school district. So the school district pays that rate of $150, and then they apply for the reimbursement from the state for whatever, you know, that amount could possibly be, depending on how many apply.
And
Representative Newton.
Chair, if I may continue, just as a matter of information, when I'm not here, I do teach at the Minsky facility, and we have also, as we receive PSEO students, the Minsko schools also receive less than what it costs to have the student there. And it's primarily due to the books. The books run, you know, as anyone who's been in school recently knows, they run $150 to $250 a piece, and that's not reimbursed to Minsko. Mm-hmm. And then another question of Ms. Palmer, if I may, Madam Chair.
Representative Newton.
As Minsko, we're seeing across the board in virtually all of the two-year colleges a decrease in the number of students. So you're showing an overall increase in courses and AP, PSEO type of courses, and yet the colleges themselves are seeing a decrease in student attendance. Is that primarily because more students are taking AP courses and college and school courses, or do you know why that's happening?
So, Madam Chair and Representative, so if I understand your question, the question is that you're seeing a reduction of PSEO students, but yet still we're seeing an increase of other concurrent enrollment kinds of options. Is that your question?
Yes.
Representative.
Chair, yes.
Ms. Palmer.
I don't really know how I could, know the answer to that question. We know that a student who does take some kind of college credit while they're still in high school is it much more likely to enroll in a post-secondary institution as well as be able to persist and complete. But the difference I don't know how the numbers add up as to how many are taking and how many are actually going into post-secondary, PSEO students going into post-secondary, and how that relates to the reduction of Minsko's declining numbers.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for having this discussion today. It's drilling down on this is good. Ms. Palmer, is that correct? Okay. I'm trying to figure out, and as folks around here know, I don't do math on the fly well. So trying to drill down to actually how many students are taking concurrent enrollment classes and how many are taking AP classes. Because the numbers are presented slightly differently, and I think Representative Newton may have been trying to get into the same thing. Do you have that number in a way that's simple enough for me to understand?
Well, Palmer. Madam Chair and Representatives, we do have the number of students taking AP courses, and I can give you that specific number, and IB courses. What we are not able to track at this point in time is the exact number of concurrent enrollment, because our concurrent enrollment numbers that we have are based on schools' applications for reimbursement. So it could conceivably be we have a school or more that offers concurrent enrollment, and I'm not talking AP and IB because we do have those numbers, but other types of concurrent enrollment who do not apply for reimbursement. So our numbers don't capture that. So our numbers are relative to the applications that we receive from the school districts.
Representative Dabney.
All right, thank you. Madam Chair, one more question from Ms. Palmer. Do you have information on the content area of courses, particularly college and schools, but I guess AP as well? I won't ask how many because that's hard to answer. Well, maybe I will. Math classes, science classes, world language classes, English classes, and so on, so that we can try to understand what's being offered, what's being taken, where there's greater interest, lesser interest. Mm-hmm. Can you help us with any of that?
Madam Chair and Representatives. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I interrupted you. Again, that kind of goes back to sort of that same phenomena that I mentioned before. We know based on what schools report to us, but we don't have specific courses per se that they're required to report to us. So while there may be some way through this new SLED system To track some of that information, that's not something that would necessarily come to us through the finance exchange part of it, piece of it. Does that make sense?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Ms. Palmer, what we've got is that mythical elephant where you're grabbing onto one leg and somebody else has got the trunk and somebody else has, I don't know, the ears, and eventually we'll put it all together. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Dabney. All right. Representative Wills, and if we can make it real brief because we have a long list of people with some innovative programs that they would like to share with us. So.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Palmer, my question is in regards to PSEO participation among different high school settings. If we know, and I don't know if it's tracked, like what percentage of homeschoolers take advantage of it, what percentage of public schoolers take advantage of it by setting, do we track that information?
Ms. Palmer.
Madam Chair and representatives, that's something that I can get to you as well, see if I can break it down by the types of schools or the types of settings that are participating.
And Representative Wills, and to the members of the committee, there is some information that was put together for members in our folder from nonpartisan research. So, Ms. Representative
Wills. May I add something to that question, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So we did provide you a list of the schools particularly that participate in concurrent enrollment. And then there's a map that shows as well, but the school districts are listed on that document. Thank you.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was looking over that document, and it gives the numbers within those high school settings, but what I'd like to see is a further breakdown, and maybe Mr. Strom has that kind of information, as within that, what percentage? So are we seeing a higher percentage of homeschoolers taking advantage of it or a higher percentage of public schoolers taking advantage of it within their setting, if that makes sense?
Yes, and we will see if we can get that for you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And I know this is a topic we are going to be doing a lot of discussion on as we move into our budgeting process. So I thank you both very much for being here. We get the technology sorted out here. I'll just mention that our first testifier is going to be Mr. Roy Smith from the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, or IRRRB, as we refer to it here, and Minsky. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Roy Smith. I'm the Director of Education and Talent Development. An interesting position I share between the IRRRB, the State Economic Development Agency in northeastern Minnesota, and the Northeast Higher Education District, so the five Minsky colleges located on the Iron Range. And it's great to be here. Greetings from the Iron Range, home to Representative Ann Zelks, my ninth grade civics teacher, so where I earn my money here.
There may be a test later, members.
About lingerie again.
I'm gonna do my best to get you back on schedule here, Madam Chair. I know it's a critical issue to the state. It's a particularly critical issue to us in northeastern Minnesota. I'm going to talk to you today about something called the Applied Learning Institute that I think fits perfectly with the topics that you're going to be discussing. It is one of the tools in our toolbox in northeastern Minnesota in an overall strategy that we call education-based economic development. And so let me tell you a little bit about what our region looks like right now. A changing landscape. And I would argue that many of you that live in greater Minnesota, you're facing the same challenges right now. The competition for skilled workers has never been higher. It doesn't seem that there's a day that goes by that I either hear about the skills gap or the wage gap or whatever it might be. In our region, who has a population that's older than both the state and the national average, this is a critical issue for us. And the competition for individuals with that mechanical, technical, electrical skill set operations has never been higher among the majority of our major employers in the region. Increased demand for products and services, large-scale projects on the horizon. That's a particular issue for us in northeastern Minnesota as we look at over $7 billion in capital investment going on across the region, everything from expansions to new construction to bridges being built, all sorts of things happening and all major, major projects in our region. As you know, we're known for an area that does big stuff. All leading to this idea of we're all in it together. The range, sometimes known for its parochialism, realizes that we still live in a region where 30 minutes behind the wheel gets you 30 miles down the road. And so people are commuting across the region, and so a project on one end of the range means jobs for individuals across the range as our supplier and vendor chain continues to grow. Retirement's at an all-time high right now in our region. And like many rural areas, the decrease in the emerging workforce and the ability to replace those highly skilled workers is an issue for us as well. All, of course, leading to what I think is tremendous opportunity. I find it fascinating that I'm back on the Iron Range after spending 20-some-odd years as a teacher and a high school administrator, all in the state of Nevada. Because when I graduated from high school in 1981 on the Iron Range, there weren't a lot of opportunities around for students my age. You basically got your diploma and a set of luggage and found your way off the range. And now there are opportunities galore for individuals if they have the right skills. So this is really what our population looks like right now. We're in the in 2015. As you can see, the population over the age of 55 is increasing at about a rate of 27%, while the workers coming up to replace them decreases by about 5%. If we push it out another 10 years to 2025, we see it really takes off on us, as it does for most of the state. Somewhere there in 2020, across the nation, you know that more people will be leaving the workforce than entering it. And so for us in rural northeastern Minnesota, it continues to be an issue. So we're looking at how do we really truly need, in the words of the Governor's Workforce Development Council, all hands on deck in our region to fill the jobs that are coming available. This is the major employers in our region with populations that are nearing retirement age, and you can see that it's everywhere. All of our major employers, healthcare, mining, pulp and paper, power generation, and the huge supplier and vendor network that supplies all of them. This is what our high school populations look like across the region. 2015, we lost in those 7 years almost 1,000 students across northeastern Minnesota. When I graduated from high school in Hibbing, 1981, we graduated over 400 students. And my daughter, who is a seventh grader this year, will graduate with a class that will struggle to break 120. And that's indicative of every community across the region. And you know that we're home to a place that is highly dependent on a highly skilled workforce. A natural resources-based economy moving very quickly to a knowledge-based economy. The supplier and vendor chain continues to grow, and all again in need of skilled workers. This is the growth report for northeastern Minnesota, where the jobs will be. You can't see that, but that's because there are so many of them. About 95% of the jobs coming available in the region require two-year career and technical program. Do we need four-year degrees? Absolutely, but the lion's share of the growth is in the two-year programs. Skills versus equals opportunities. The Applied Learning Institute has been our solution to this. What we had seen historically is that many of the programs that were once so prevalent in northeastern Minnesota in industrial arts, because of budget cuts and declining enrollments, were swept out the door. And our high school students who were interested in the skilled trades did not have an opportunity to pursue their passion at their high school, get some experience. I'm not sure what we want to do with that. Oh, okay, we'll just pop out of there. And so we saw a decrease in individuals pursuing those careers in the skilled trades that are desperately needed. And so the Applied Learning Institute is really that renewal of technical education in the region. I'm gonna skip over this because we're running short on time. This is a commercial that runs on television for us. This is what our organization looks like. It's a collaboration of 22 high schools across the region in 17 school districts, coupled with the 5 community and technical colleges in the region, offering students an opportunity to train on state-of-the-art equipment, state-of-the-art curricula, in their high school while earning college credit through a concurrent enrollment agreement that you just discussed, and it is working for us in the region. These are the areas of study based on DEED's high growth, high demand for our region: industrial technology, engineering. We have a 4-year engineering school in northeastern Minnesota now, so students can ladder into that. Construction trades, transportation and mechanical systems, and healthcare. So students can come out of high school with anywhere from a minimum of 3 to a maximum of anywhere from 15 to 18, again, depending on how many electives they have open in their schedule, that ladder into the programs at the Northeast Higher Education District colleges. I'm going to skip over that as well. Get to the question that you're all wondering. Is it working? Is the investment of roughly $6.5 million since 2006 in the region, is it working? And this is what we see: satisfied customers. In a report that we just had commissioned by the Wilder Foundation, the evaluation talks with teachers, parents, students, and employers in the region. Our students are out working now, the students that started originally in the program. Very satisfied. Parents love it. Their kid finally has passion about going to school. The students love it because they're getting their hands dirty. I know Representative Rukavina used to always say, if a kid can't lose a finger, it's not an ALI class. So we want to make sure that our students are training on state-of-the-art curricula. Safety is a huge issue. We average anywhere from 1,200 to 1,500 students per year participating in ALI classes across the region. Over 8,000 students have participated so far. Since 2006, enrollment in our college technical programs has gone up 76%. That's a huge number for us. It's so big that for 2 of our 5 colleges, and these have been around, Representative Anzelks, from the early 1900s,
yes.
Hibbing Community College, Mesabi Range, first time in history, graduations on the technical side of the house exceed graduations on the liberal arts side of the house. And so students are taking notice, they're working, they're introduced to those college classes, they get to know the instructor because they're mentored by them at the high school level, and they're matriculating on. What does it do for us in terms of our competitive advantage in the region? We are 55% higher than the national average in northeastern Minnesota of people walking around with a technical certificate or a degree. 55% higher. And so when businesses come to us at IRRRB looking to relocate, expand in the region, it's now the first question they ask. 15, 20 years ago, they used to ask us, will you build us a building? Can we get an interest-free loan? Is there a wage subsidy? Now it's, am I going to find the talent? And is there the educational infrastructure there to provide the training that we're going to produce for our workforce? Number one question. So it's retaining talent in our region, and it's a critical tool for us for economic development. And so that's what I have, Madam Chair, for the Applied Learning Institute. I know you're busy, but I'm open for questions at any time now or anytime you need me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mm-hmm. Smith. Really quick question, and I don't want to eat into other testimony time, but do other areas of the state consult with you, and the program you've developed, is it something that could be replicated in that in other areas of the state?
Madam Chair, representatives, it could absolutely be replicated anywhere in the state. This would be, Madam Chair, my only caution as you look at this as a committee is that whatever you decide to allow some freedom for regions to determine what works best in their region. The Applied Learning Institute works perfectly in our region because of the legislative support that we have, the collaboration between the colleges and the high schools. That doesn't happen everywhere. The industry buy-in, it works for us, and we've built it around our economy. What would work in southeastern Minnesota? The model of ALI can work anywhere. The partnerships that drive ALI take some work, and I'm willing to help with that anywhere I can.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Anzels, did you have anything? And you're familiar, clearly, but...
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for having Mr. Smith here. We're always happy to explain to committee members when good things, innovative things are happening on the Iron Range, so thank you for the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And we may have to work on a different standard than Representative Rukavina's, but I'm glad you're I'm glad you're working on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. I'm not sure if I pronounce this right, but Minnesota Association of Agriculture Educators, Mike Myron or Myron?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Myron. I am a secondary agriculture, food, and natural resources teacher from the Forest Lake School District here in Minnesota. And so I bring a perspective from this particular area of career and technical education. Certainly Forest Lake, not that far away. We still have a robust offering of agriculture courses available to our students. Just in our secondary program, we see about, to give you some perspective of the students I see, we see about 700 students a year as our annual enrollment. They are engaging in courses such as plant sciences, animal sciences, natural resource sciences. We also have offerings in economics and agribusiness, as well as leadership. Now, one area that we don't serve that a lot of agriculture programs do is power, technical, and structural systems. That's simply because we have a fantastic industrial technology program that's already providing those things. So in the Forest Lake area, we've been very fortunate that we've been able to maintain our career and technical education programs to help build these bridges from secondary programming to post-secondary and eventually career. We see students in grades 8 through 12 in all of our buildings, secondary buildings, the high school, the junior high, and I actually got my start at our area learning center with our students that were at risk. And so our model is fairly simple. We try to take some classroom instruction, high-quality classroom instruction, pair it with experiential learning. In agriculture, we call that supervised agricultural experience programs, an opportunity for students to get out in the real world, to experience agriculture as it's happening out in industry, and connect that with their classroom learning, and then pair that with our leadership development through a career and technical education student organization program. In our situation, that is FFA. And when we put those pieces together, we certainly hope that that leads to continued post-secondary education for our students in the area of agriculture or training that eventually leads to a high-quality career. You've heard a lot about the different offerings available to career and technology education students here today. We offer many of them. We have college and the schools course offerings in agriculture. We actually have two partnerships with the University of Minnesota, both in horticulture as well as animal sciences, and see a number of students taking advantage of those opportunities. Right now, we're working very hard to make a similar partnership with the Minsky School so that we can offer a similar type of college and the schools offering with them to provide another avenue for college credit and another pathway for post-secondary success for students. We are also offering articulated agreements with Minsky colleges so that students can take advantage of maybe some tuition reduction programs or enrollment credits so that they might see that as an avenue of continued success. We have a partnership with Mayo Clinic. We're actually offering microbiology and genetics. We're getting a lot of training as teachers through that and then utilizing the resources that they can provide to offer those to our students as well. And finally, we also offer certification. We have a variety of what we call technical skill assessments in our area of agriculture. Those are national assessments that hopefully can provide some credentialing or certifications for students upon completion of that nationally accredited test. So there's a lot of different pieces taking place in career and technical education along with agriculture education that we think are contributing to this world's best workforce philosophy and helping build that bridge from what's happening in a classroom to what can lead to post-secondary training, post-secondary education, and eventually career. We do have some challenges, however, that we hope will lead to opportunities. In agriculture, as well as all in career and technical education, we have a shortage of teachers. And so we're really working very hard to try to recruit teachers, to try to find teachers in this shortage area. And we're going to need some creative ideas to help recruit those people out of potential industry jobs into classroom jobs so that they can provide that skill and experience and that knowledge and pass it on to potential students. So I appreciate the time here today to share and certainly would answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Muran. And I think Representative Detmer wanted to have a word here with the committee, and he's very proud to have you here today, so we appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Muran, well, back in the days, I'd call you Mikey, but a student of mine, and
did he wrestle for you, Coach?
No, he didn't.
Okay,
didn't.
I was one of the few, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I was probably one of the few farm students who didn't wrestle for Representative Detmer.
But Mr. Muran grew up on a dairy farm, and his brother and his dad still takes care of the big dairy operation in Forest Lake area, and his dad is the county commissioner of one of the county commissioners of Washington County, the FFA program at Forest Lake High School is not one of the best in the state, but one of the best in the nation. And what they've done with the ag department is it's a diamond, I know, in our principal's eye at Forest Lake High School. So just a lot of kudos to you and what you're doing there. And your sister also teaches in the department there. And you have another brother that teaches and another sister that is teaching in another school district in the ag. So just thank you for being here today. And what he mentioned about there's a shortage of teachers in the ag area is something that really, you know, maybe we should be taking a look at how we can encourage people to go into education and teach in the area of agriculture. This is something I think is really important.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Detmer. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wondered, I see that FFA is through you, and I know there's a program where FFA students from rural bring their animals into inner city grade schools, which I've actually seen the kids so excited and actually become interested in farms. Is that part of your program, or is that a different thing?
Mr. Muran.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, some of my colleagues do bring in animals from greater Minnesota and share that information and those experiences with some of our students here closer to the metro area. As a teacher in a district that I consider fairly suburban, we have plenty of agriculture literacy and programming that we're doing in our own school district to help encourage young people to know about the opportunities that are available in agriculture and the things that they can do career-wise in this growing and expanding area. So that's definitely something that's happening across the state in lots of different areas and lots of different ways.
Thank you. All right, well, thank you, Mr. Muran. You've given us some other great points to ponder. We appreciate that. All right. I'm going to ask now of the people planning to testify, if anyone has come from a distance, I'll say 50 miles or more, okay, because I'm worried we're going to run out of time. Okay, so let's have the folks from a distance testify next, and then we'll go back into the order. And I'm hoping we can get everybody in today, but just on the off chance we can't, I don't want anybody who's traveled distance to have to come back again. So come on down, Minnesota Rural Education Association, is that correct? Welcome. Please state your name for the
record. Thank you. I'm Fred Nolan, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association. MRAA is the voice of 199 school districts from border to border in Minnesota and 12 education districts educating about 186,000 kids every day. You all should have our 2015 platform, so I'm not going to pass it out or go through it. It was mailed to you. But I'm going to highlight a few things out of that platform that are specifically to CTE and post-secondary transition between high school and post-secondary. The first most lasting change we'd like you to address is the Minnesota Academic Standards. For 13 years with the MAS, we have clearly focused on college ready. But what about career ready? What about getting ready for the complex challenges of the work of civic participation and managing personal affairs in contemporary world? For example, we teach students all about the micro and macroeconomics, but not about personal finance and how they're going to wait to earn their way into the economy. We expect students to know all about American history and civics, but not how to register to vote. We devote three semesters to geography, but not any time to what it really would take to live in any of those places. And we have all students take Algebra 2 when extremely few jobs use Algebra 2. I do a lot of data analysis. I crunch a lot of spreadsheets. I never use Algebra 2. I use Algebra 1. And you'll find that from most CTE employers. That's the level at which people really need to proficient. So we'd recommend that you appoint a working group over the summer to pare down the number of academic standards we have. So there's room to add standards that relate to a young person entering the workforce. So we really have the world's best workforce in reality. And reconsider requiring Algebra 2 and a second year of science, and consider some of the technical fields and some of the other electives in mathematics or technical science that would be applicable, and provide room in student schedule to take those. I would carefully make sure that you look at who's going to be on that, how you structure that, and what the charge of that committee is. But fundamentally, if you don't do that, there's no room for all these great ideas you're going to hear in student schedules. And in CTE, there are two immediate actions that the committee can do to increase students' awareness of clean manufacturing in demand high-tech jobs, as was described from the representative, from the person from the range. First of all, expand the learning year on a voluntary basis for schools and students that want high-quality academics, band and choir, and high-tech by using the summer. Schools are empty. Teachers generally are not employed. Students don't have summer jobs like they used to. And you can do this by expanding the funding for extended time. This would be very similar to targeted services, which is only for remedial help in math and reading. But use it as a concept for schools who want to offer CTE courses, maybe up to 6 weeks. Due to the expense of the equipment and materials, probably a 0.25 reimbursement, a maximum, would work. In targeted services, it's 0.2. This would be voluntary, and in that we would encourage schools to collaborate with their local businesses and industries to make it a full experience with job shadowing, etc. That's one specific thing you can do. The second is we're actually going to have a proposal, a bill drafted, for putting 21st century tools in the hands of kids for experiential learning. Virtual robotics and welding are very expensive. Small schools can't afford to buy this piece of equipment, use it for 4 to 6 weeks, put it in a closet for the rest of the year. What we're proposing is consortiums of up to 8 schools would buy equipment and be able to then share it so it would move around. They're doing it in North Dakota. We have a scalable proposal that would allow schools up to 8 to get together. It's almost a one-to-one match between the state and the schools over a four-year period, and it's one-time money. It's to get them started, and then with the funding mechanism and the curriculum would be on their thing, and that would work. So we will be back specifically to talk about that when it becomes a bill. And finally, there's a lot of interest in post-secondary concurrent enrollment. It is incredibly probably that more kids, if they take that, do go on to post-secondary, and there'll be some attention to the proration. You've already seen that, but I want to highlight an issue that I think is under discussed, and that is the mismatch between schools and colleges' legitimate views on what the qualifications are for a master teacher. In rural high schools, teachers need to teach multiple grades, multiple courses within a discipline. We need master teachers with thorough understanding of pedagogy, building relationships, unit and lesson planning. And, oh, by the way, did we ask you to coach two subjects, two things or sports or lead an activity? That's what the life of a rural high school teacher is. And many private and public universities offer general master's degrees to help us teach become master teachers. For colleges, they want instructors with deep and thorough understanding of the content. Thoroughly understand that. But master's and subject areas are only offered during the day on campus at our universities. High school teachers have to take time off from teaching, a year off, to actually go do that. This is a mismatch. Statewide, you can see this. So we recommend that you do two things in this committee, and you need to work with the higher ed committee. First, establish a scholarship program for rural high school teachers to pursue master's degrees in their subject area. And secondly, direct MNSCU to establish weekend and cohort blended virtual master's programs or specific content set of courses for a teacher who already has a master's, but it was more pedagogical, it wasn't content, but in mathematics, in English, in higher science, so they can take those courses virtually, statewide, to get that deep conceptual understanding that the colleges want for their courses. Again, it's a mismatch. Neither is right, neither is wrong. It's just you're trying to achieve two different goals and try to figure out how you're going to do it with that same person who's in a rural high school. This wouldn't be the only route that rural high school teachers could use to gain the depth of knowledge, but it would establish a route, and it would have a beneficial effect of increasing the content knowledge of our high school teachers. And I know Representative Erdahl, where are you? He's not here. Okay,
he is on this.
Okay, the Finnish advocate. This is their model, and it would have a beneficial effect. It's a tall order. Our teachers want to get better. They want to do an excellent job with their kids. They need some assistance and some pathways to get there. So those are four ideas we hope you pursue over the course. I appreciate your time. MRAA is willing to work with you on any of these ideas, and I'm open to take questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nolan. Clearly some thought-provoking ideas in there and given us a little bit to chew on here in the committee. We appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you and from your association again.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. Was there anyone else who had come from a distance of 50 miles or more? All right. If not, we will go back, and we may run a little bit long, just so people are aware today. We'll try to get through this if we can. Inger Wegner from the Minnesota Association for Career and Technical Education. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Inger Wegener, and I am currently employed at the University of Minnesota in the College of Education and Human Development as a Career and Technical Education Coordinator. I also have 20 years experience working in rural Minnesota in Career and Tech Ed regional secondary consortias, and served 29 high schools in a 7-county area. But today I am in front of you speaking as the legislative chair for a professional organization called Minnesota Association for Career and Technical Educators. And I just wanted to share with you some highlights and accomplishments of secondary career and tech ed. MNACTE, the Minnesota Association for Career and Technical Education, is a statewide professional association for career and tech ed at both the secondary and post-secondary level. We serve the entire state from Roseau to Stuartville, from Grand Marais down to Pipestone. And we are associated with a national organization, the Association for Career and Technical Education, and their Midwest region of 7 states. MNACTE represents all career and technical education program areas. Those include agriculture, business, family and consumer sciences, health occupations, marketing, service occupations, special needs, that is disadvantaged and disabled students, and trade and technical education, which is a very large category but includes communication technology, construction, manufacturing, and transportation. We do represent teachers and instructors and faculty and administrators and service providers in the education system for a broad array of programs that deliver career and employment preparation. We are also the foundation for the nationally recognized student organizations for career and tech ed that include BPA for Business, FCCLA and HERO for Family and Consumer Sciences, FFA for Agriculture, HOSA for the Health Sciences, and Skills USA in the trade and technical areas. Secondary career and technical education has truly unique curricular content. We address applied academics, and we have many years of experience with implementing mathematics standards into career and technical education programs, taking theory of mathematics and putting it in contextual, applied, authentic applications. We are also implementing science and engineering standards in our career and tech ed. In fact, many of our manufacturing construction programs were ahead of the curve with engineering standards. They have been addressing manufacturing issues for a long time. We also address the English language arts standards in career and tech ed. We work on the technical reading and reading for truly complex and deeper meaning in our materials. And we also are a home for Project Lead the Way, both in engineering and the biosciences. Career and technical education also addresses experiential learning through our work-based learning components. It includes the entire spectrum of work-based learning, from job shadowing and mentoring to industry tours to work experience and paid employment to apprenticeships. We do the entire range. And in experiential learning, which also appears in the world's best workforce legislation, we work on foundation skills, such as the higher order thinking skills of decision making and problem solving, academic knowledge that is in context, employability skills, ethics, and safety and health and environment issues. In addition, Career and Tech Ed has a required component in their curriculum to address career development and assist students in understanding career preparation and career planning. Career and Tech Ed programs are designed to help students understand the variety and nature of technical careers. It provides them opportunities to explore careers. It helps students evaluate potential careers. It helps them understand the importance of preparation for career change and the need for lifelong learning, and to develop job-seeking and job-keeping skills and their career portfolios. Finally, Career and Tech Ed does address, as well, technical skill assessment. We have industry-recognized technical skill assessments and attainment that are portable and transferable for those students. We have the articulation agreements, as you heard earlier, concurrent enrollment options that include online college in the high school and PSEO models. So overall, my message to share with you is the present state of career and tech ed in Minnesota. We have seen in the past 2 years a tremendous growth in interest and implementation of state-approved secondary career and tech ed programs. I attribute this directly to the result of your 2012 legislation reinstating career and technical education state aid and increasing the annual appropriations for the career and tech ed levy. It has provided for a broader range of CTE content areas available to students, and it increases the ability for students to be served by fully licensed teachers of career and technical education. So on behalf of the members of MNACTI, CTE students and parents, and the CTE community and partners and stakeholders. We thank you for your interest in, concern for, and support of career and technical education in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Wagner. We appreciate your testimony today. All right, let's see. Connie Hayes with the Intermediate School Districts. Is Connie here?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Connie Hayes. I'm superintendent at Intermediate School District 916, and I'm here to represent all three of the intermediate school districts. I want to tell you a little bit about our role in career and technical education and serving our member districts, and then I'll tell you briefly a little bit about our specific career and tech program at 916. In fiscal year 14, nearly 2,000 students attended our career and technical education programs in our combined 33 member districts across the three intermediates. Students sign up for their career and tech classes each year when they're signing up for their high school courses. And you've got the brochure for the 916 courses for fiscal year 16 in your hands. They typically come to our campus and take a two-hour block of time for their career and tech class in their high school schedule. The intermediate districts work very closely with the member districts to develop the programs to give students experience in many fields of study. The programs are developed on the marketplace data where there are good paying jobs, really great paying jobs. By working with a collaborative group of districts at the intermediate school district, each of our local high schools actually builds their capacity to serve their students with an expanded curriculum they could not replicate in their own high schools. You can't run a high school course for five students, but if you gather five students here, three students there, another one, another six, and bring them together, pretty soon you've got a course that you can run in a career pathway that just a few students might have an interest in at their local high school. Our 916 Career and Tech Center is located on the campus of Century College and offers coursework, as you can see in our brochure, from automotive technology to construction occupations to dental to law enforcement, and we even offer an honors mentor connection for gifted and talented students. Our teachers are industry trained and connect to their business and industry areas through their own professional organizations and beyond. And with that strong connection, students get the opportunity to network and make connections for their future opportunities. At the same time our students are getting their high school credit, our programs also offer credit, college credit in 15 programs articulated with more than 20 colleges. Last year, we estimated nearly 3,000 potential college credits were earned and over 1,200 professional certifications were earned. In our concurrent enrollment program, our principal just shared with me 173 students are currently enrolled, 535 credits with a savings of over nearly $100,000 for those students this year. Our student success is really a testament to the success of our career and tech program, and it can really open the doors for our young people. This fall, I had the great opportunity to meet a 24-year-old young man by the name of Chris Knudsen, who got his start in our construction occupations class at 916, and he now has a very promising career at Krauss Anderson Construction. Chris not only got great experience in gaining some skills, but he was recognized by Krauss as having the skill and drive, and he was quickly recognized as someone they wanted to employ. Those connections that our teachers help establish are really a nice benefit to the program. I like to say that part of our challenge in career and tech education is a marketing problem. Career and tech has not yet gained the glimmer and the glitz of that we've created for a four-year college education, but we can change that here in Minnesota. Many kids can do very well in gaining some technical skills to begin their work and their careers, which might later bring them back to a four-year college. But not everyone needs to start there. Career and tech courses help students and their families navigate which pathway is right for each individual student. Thank you very much for your interest in career and technical education.
All right, Ms. Hayes, thank you very much. Representative Mullery, I'm going to, if it's a very brief question, I'll allow, but I want to announce, here's my plan. We're about at 2:30. Because we started late, we're going to go a few minutes late, and I know there's caucuses and everything before the session, but I hope as many members will stick around as we can. And I am going to try to get the following people up to testify today. And for those of you I can't get in, I apologize, but the ones I'm going to bump are the representatives of a couple of education groups that I know we'll hear from frequently, and we will come back to this topic a number of times yet this year. So I'm going to want to hear from Mr. Erickson from Minnetonka High School, Jeff McMonagle from Anoka Hennepin, Terry Henry from Minneapolis Public Schools, and Joe Nathan with the Center for School Change. And we're going to work all that in by 2:45. So, Representative Mullery.
Thank you. Quick question, Madam Chair. Minneapolis and St. Paul's schools aren't in any of these districts, I don't think. Can students living there somehow get in on these two-hour programs or and work with their districts or anything like that?
Yes, that is true. Neither Minneapolis or St. Paul are members of the intermediate districts, but if those member districts want to enroll their students in our programs, we would certainly welcome them.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much. All right, so Mr. Erickson with Minnetonka High School. And right after him, we'll go with Mr. Henry from Minneapolis Public Schools, and then Anoka Hennepin right after that. Welcome.
Thank you very much. My name is Jeff Erickson, the principal of Minnetonka High School. And thank you for the opportunity to share the work at Minnetonka High School to ensure that each student is college and career ready. Minnetonka High School has a very robust advanced placement and international baccalaureate program that provides college-level rigor for students in the high school. I'd like to thank the Minnetonka School Board and Minnesota Legislature for supporting these programs that have really proven to prepare students for success in college. Just a few points of data. The class of 2014, 70% of our students took AP and IB courses, doubling in the past 5 years. We had 414 AP scholars and 48 IP diplomas earned. Our ACT average since adding the IB program in 2004 has increased from 24.1 in 2006 to 26.5. One of our students recently presented at the school board and left Minnetonka High School with 51 credits when he arrived at the University of Minnesota Duluth, walking right in with that based on his work in AP and IB. By continuing to support the advanced placement and other college-level programs in high schools, we're allowing to achieve the goal of supporting increased rigor in college and career readiness without requiring students to leave and to go into a college campus, an environment for some which are not emotionally or socially ready for that experience. There's a significant difference, obviously, between a 16-year-old and a 21-plus on a college campus. Part of the work that we've looked at within some of the systems, when they leave us for PSEO, for example, some students, again, aren't ready, aren't provided the support that we can do within our walls. The AP experience for us and IB is for all students. Our goal is for when students leave our school that they're able to take at least one course in AP or IB, knowing that that will help prepare them for four-year experiences. As a district, we are focused on creating innovative experiences for our students. I'd like to conclude by sharing the experience of one of our students enrolled in our new Vantage program. Vantage is an interdisciplinary approach to learning in which students take 2 to 3 courses off-site. So we have a facility just down the road from Minnetonka High School, and they have 2 to 3 courses that are really looking at application of the content. So one of the courses that I would share is Global Business, in which students take an IB business course, an AP economics course, and a general level English course. Students complete this coursework in a professional setting by our own instructors, but not only our own instructors involved with this process, we have guest instructors several times a week from leading industry, Cargill, General Mills, Emerson, for example. Students then take their knowledge and apply it to specific projects from our partner companies. They really have a rich experience that I believe, and we've looked at the information, is unmatched even what they'll find during college-level internships that happen during that high school experience. One of our students last year worked with Aspire Beverage Company. Their goal was to create the next flavor for that company. They did all the marketing, all the work, applying what they learned in the classroom. And that program is for all students. One of our students, James, was a hardworking student, started in ninth grade in an alternative learning program. Due to his desire to succeed, he applied for the Vantage program as a junior in the spring of 2014. He was accepted based on his maturity, ability to work independently, and high level of trust. Today, due to his professionalism and ethics, he's one of the top performers in his class. He was recently accepted into a university where he'll be the first member of his high school, first member of his family to attend college. The students that I mentioned are just several examples of what we believe represent the strong academic experiences that students receive within the walls of Minnetonka High School. I'm proud of the experiences that our students receive at Minnetonka High School and their excellent preparation for their post-secondary work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we appreciate you being succinct. And Representative Seltzer, I know you're a proud representative of this high school. I'll give you a minute.
That's exactly what I wanted to say, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. I'm just so proud to have Mr. Erickson here and briefly describe the great programs that are going on at Minnetonka, where they really are taking seriously having every student career ready. So thank you very much for being here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, Mr. Henry from Minneapolis Public Schools.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Graffalt with Minneapolis Schools. I'm just carrying Mr. Henry's paper and
welcome.
Would like a good lobbyist will do that. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
And then introduce him. Mr. Henry is a good example of what we need to do to go outside of the state to bring talent in. Comes to us from Indiana and is our Executive Director of College and Career Readiness. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, delegates and representatives. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about the broad spectrum of work of Minneapolis Public Schools and our belief in making sure that every student is college and career ready. This spring, MPS is going to implement the national model for Jobs for America's graduates. JAG is one of the nation's largest, if not arguably most successful, school-to-work system programs for at-risk and disadvantaged students. Our junior-senior model will focus on supporting students in school through graduation while equipping them with technical skills necessary for them to be improve their post-secondary success. Our MPS JAG students will earn dual credit. Our Minneapolis Career Readiness and Course elective and two-year credits per semester from Hennepin Technical College. This program will focus on increasing attendance, doubling the rate of workforce employment, and actively serve our high-risk first-generation population. This work is housed within my department, which is CCR, and was selected by building-level leadership to impact our district's contract alternative programs, which are Heritage, Wellstone, our combined program with PYC and VOA, which is Volunteers of America, combined program with Henry and Edison, and a potential site with Broadway, which is our community school for pregnant and parenting students. JAG requires no less than 1 year of follow-up and support after the students have graduated. We've hired 3 JAG specialists and 1 coordinator, which they are here today with us and representing, and who will provide instruction during the in-school phase, data collection, as well as the follow-up support for our services after graduation. Our district JAG team will hold dual accountability with 35 to 45 students per class. The bottom line result of our participants is that each of these young people will become MPS graduates and enter the workforce and college entrance or join our nation's active military or active service. With this level of national success, you're likely wondering why this program is not already hosted in Minnesota. Minnesota once ran a modest JAG program. It was Jobs for Minnesota Graduates, which was funded through a court desegregation order. These funds were funded that supported 4 schools in Northwest Suburban Integration School District. The last program was in Elk River, closed after funds were depleted after 2010 and 2011 school year. In my prior work, JAG was essential towards increasing our service to urban youth. My prior state actively participated toward financially supporting this program. I ask the committee to review the implementation of the MPS JAG program and focus fiscal support towards district-wide implementation, not only in MPS, but also across a broad spectrum of school districts. I've included data and a short explanation on the upcoming work that we're going to be having here in MPS, and I want to thank you for your time and attention and support. I cut this down just so I can make sure that you can have all the time that's there. I also wanted to make sure that this was put on official record and report, because I know that you do that. I love my daughter Braylee and Bryce Henry, and they are extremely and important and special. That's what she wanted me to say today.
We don't want to disappoint them, so I'm glad you were able to work that in.
Absolutely not.
And I thank you very much, and I apologize. We're not giving your testimony all the time that it deserves, and I appreciate your brevity, but again, we will be coming back to this, and I'm very interested in the proposal. Really quick question.
Sure.
How much money is the Minneapolis School District investing in this program?
Right now, this program is being funded through integration funds, which, okay, if you notice, we chose our contract alternatives because that funding can be on those highest served for those students. At the same time, we're pulling from different divisions to make sure that it's sustainable. Our ultimate goal is to reach it across the board to all of our high schools, and that's what's most important. And as the state continues to look at funding this across the board, all the colleagues that have sat at this desk and presented wonderful programs, I assure they will take this on as well.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your being here today and your testimony.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. McMonagall from Anoka Hennepin. And Mr. Nathan, you're going to close us out for today. So. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff McGonigal. I'm the Associate Superintendent for High Schools for the Anoka Hennepin School District, which involves eight high school campuses. And I'm going to just quickly touch on three programs I think that are worthy of note that we're excited about. First of all, we have our secondary technical education program known as STEP that's familiar to many people in the state. What I wanted to mention about our STEP program connected to the Tech College is we have worked really hard in the past few years to increase the number of students earning concurrent credit at STEP. We've had high success with our students. In fact, 2 years ago, we had 250 students graduate who would have earned college credit because their scores were high enough in their exit exams, except that only 24 of them finished the paperwork to start the program. At age 15, the paperwork required for them to be eligible for college credit is onerous. And I just wanted the committee to be aware of the fact that we can get CTE concurrent credit if we follow that paperwork, but right now that is a challenge. The good news is we've been able to overcome that, and we've gotten the number over 200 this past year. Our second program I wanted to mention is a part of our Area Learning Center. We have a campus that only has students whose graduating classes have moved on. And often those Area Learning Center students or the Area Learning Centers themselves are seen as a place where students are going to cross a finish line. And we want to have something better for them than that. What we've done is move student, what they call super seniors, but for students whose graduating classes have already graduated, we're moving them into a campus on the Technical College campus, and they're going to now have the same opportunities our STEP students have for concurrent enrollment credit. In essence, they're going to be receiving free Technical College credit and be partway through a program by the time they graduate from high school. And these are going to be for students who are 19 and 20 and 21. This is a pretty big move, and we're excited about that. And then the last program we have is called Bridge. It's underway at Anoka High School. For a graduating class of about 600 students, we have about 400 that are taking a ninth grade math class that's beefing them up for college so that they're not remediating college credit their freshman year in college, and we'll be taking that same group of students through an English class in their 10th grade year. They will become college eligible by the time that they're juniors, and this is a lot of students at one school. And what we need then for them are more articulated credits, college credits, their junior and senior year, and we have trouble with that. We have two great institutions we're partnering with, Anoka Ramsey and St. Cloud State, but as you heard in some other presentations earlier, we struggle with the credentialing requirements, and it's not just a rural issue. That's an issue in Anoka Hennepin as well. And with the differences between the Board of Teaching requirements and tenure law, we can have somebody that we invest quite a bit of money in, get them credentialed, and they could still be less senior in their department, and we could lose them the next year during staffing. So we believe believe that some sort of coordination between the rules of the Board of Teaching and the credentialing requirements of the U and the state university system would benefit our high school programs like the ones we're putting in place right now. And in watching time, I'll conclude my remarks, and I thank you.
Thank you. Nice job. You covered some good ground in a very quick period of time, and I appreciate it, especially the last point. That is something we need to have some more discussion about. Thank you for raising it. All right, thank you. And last but not least for today, Mr. Nathan, and I would mention that someone from the College Board wanted to come and also talk about AP programs, and again, as a parent, that's the one of the concurrent enrollment and options I'm most familiar with as a parent. One of my daughters, actually both of my daughters have done that, but they weren't able to be here, and as it turns out, we wouldn't have had time anyway. So we will come back to some of our testifiers and these topics at a later date. Mr. Nathan, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you, especially to those who are able to stay. I know that there are many demands on your time. I'll be brief within 2 minutes. You've heard a lot of discussion about what. I want to talk briefly about why. One-page summary is going around that describes what happens when youngsters participate in dual-credit courses. Briefly, because obviously you all can read, I'll mention just three or four studies. First, here at the University of Minnesota. My name, by the way, is Joe Nathan. I have a PhD, and I direct the Center for School Change, and I've been working on this issue for approximately 30 years. I've been a public school teacher and administrator, as well as PTA president here in Minnesota. So the University of Minnesota studied 31,000 students and found that youngsters who participated in dual credit courses of a variety of kinds, both in the high school and on college credits, in the critical first year at the University of Minnesota when many youngsters leave, students from low-income families who participated in dual credit courses of the variety that you've heard today had the same grade point average as much more affluent students who had not participated. That's called closing an achievement gap. It's a critical gap. The University of Minnesota also found that youngsters who participated in post-second enrollment options were more likely to graduate more rapidly than youngsters from other programs. Research has shown that youngsters who participate in these programs are, in Texas at least, twice as likely to graduate from high school and almost twice as likely to graduate from some form of college or university. You, sir, asked about the what's happening with the enrollment on Minsku campuses. We actually have reports from the University of Minnesota and from the Minsku campus showing the number of kids participating in these courses, both through concurrent enrollment in the high school and post-secondary options on the college campus, and those can be made available to you. I won't go through all of the items that are on here. I do want to direct your attention to the back page, which does show the historical trend, which affirms and confirms what you've heard, that the number of youngsters who are participating is increasing. There is a gap between kids of different races, but fortunately, although you can play lots of games with statistics, the number of low-income kids and the percentage of low-income kids and students of color are participating. We will have recommendations later in the session about some things that the legislature could do, both in terms of increased flexibility for high schools so that they can provide more of these opportunities. Right now, advanced placement, for example, is offered at the ninth grade level throughout the state, but there are some restrictions in law that we think make no sense that hinder a concurrent enrollment of the kind that you've talked about. These are courses offered in the high school. So we'll have some recommendations, but in the interest of time, I want to say thank you for the opportunity and look forward to working with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Nathan. And we will look forward to those recommendations at a later time. And again, I really appreciate the testifiers. Thanks for working with us on our tight time constraints today. And with that, the committee is adjourned.